I guess, yeah, lots of gene in morpho gene, but there will be also some morpho at some point. Yeah, I'm generally interested about cell fate acquisition, and I guess, so that project rose from, we work on mouse embryonic stem cells and to try to get a simpler system. That would be more practical experimentally. So we work in Phalaenopsis amylata, probably hasn't been introduced at all yet. But so it's an ascidian, and so it chordates, so close to vertebrates, but not vertebrates yet. But they have, so the larvae have notochord. It's a relative of Ciona, so probably most of you have heard of Ciona intestinalis. Now, unfortunately, it's called Ciona robusta. The advantage of Phalaenopsis compared to Ciona is that the embryos are highly transparent, so you can do nice imaging with them. There is a stereotypical lineage, and actually, so ascidians are his own developmental biology models, and so the complete lineage has been worked out already in the late 19th century by Conklin. So you have to think of that organism a bit like a vertebrate elegans, even though it's not a vertebrate. But so it has a fixed number of cells. All the cells have names, and their lineage is known, of course. So it's a very simple animal because the embryos gastrulate at 110 or 112 cells, even though there is already a very large number of cells. So you will have future germ cells, you have future brain, you have future blood precursors, you have future pretty much what anything you can think of. And ascidians also have a very complex genome, so pretty much orthos most of the genes you find in vertebrates. There has not been any genome duplication yet, so it's a simpler gene complement. So the problem of Phalaenopsis, though, is that there is no published transcriptome, there is also no published annotated genome, and ascidians are extremely highly polymorphic, so of the order of 1%. So what we had to do is assemble high-quality transcriptome and high-quality genome in order to be able to do anything with that list. So the project has been carried on the analysis side by a former student of mine, Anna Savicek, and its close collaboration with a group of Lars Hufnagel at EMBL in Heidelberg, and our postdoc, Ulamai Fusa, did all the imaging experiments. So how do the embryos look? So that's light sheet imaging of early development, starting from a few cells, and by the end of the movie, so the gastrulation will begin. So here, you see the posterior pole is here, anterior is there, and so you see from top, you see all the nuclei labeled in red and the membranes in green, and so we are interested in the early stages of that development when the embryo basically starts to pattern itself. Yes?
Are those stable transgenic lines or transient
labeled? By injection. So they are all basically shipped from Brittany. So I guess people don't grow Phalaenopsis in the lab. So I guess Ciona, some people grow it. So for example, Bill Smith here does that. But yeah, there are no transgenics. So just mRNA injection and you just watch. And as everything is kind of done by size reduction, so you don't have a problem basically of diluting your mRNAs.
And there are membrane-bound compartments at all stages? Do you think this has its own membrane?
Yeah, I think that the nuclei have their own. So the nuclei are close to the periphery, but yeah, it's not a synthesium at all whatsoever. So you have individual cells and with, yeah, organelles, everything you can think of. So the development is quite rapid. So gastrulation starts at around 5 hours, and the first cell divisions are kind of every 20 minutes.
How long is the movie? An unrelated question.
Yeah, the movie is roughly 5 hours.
Okay,
yes,
and could you also do mosaic injection if you inject later into a single cell?
Yes, so that field has very, you can do all kind of crazy experiments because you know where each cell is, so you can inject individual blastomers, and so you could have one, you can make perturbations in one half of the embryo, for example, and things like that. So, and if you segment the movie, that's how it looks. So the four, in, four blastomeres at four cell stage are each labeled with a color, and you have the progeny with similar colors, and you see that all the progeny of one cell is segregated in space. So cells that are close by are relatives to each other, and you see the vegetal pole on the left and the animal pole on the right. And so now, so we'll start up to gastrulation, and here you have the time in hours, basically. So it takes roughly 3 hours to go from 4 cell to 64 cell stage, where the initiation of gastrulation will start with. And so we wanted to get an idea of what are the changes in gene expression at early stages. And so that's pictures from Siona, but Fallusia looks pretty much the same. And what we did is we profiled carefully staged embryos of 15 different stages up to the larva. The larva is 2,600 cells only, and so but it has neurons, it can swim, and so that in fact that's a pretty fascinating animal, because you can think, yes, so few cells but so many. It's well, it's almost a vertebrate with, and it's much more complicated that you one could argue than C. elegans. But so we profiled all those stages, so very early on, so gastrula, around gastrula stages, and also later when they start to elongate the axis.
Was each of your replicates a single embryo? Or a...
No, no, so there it's in bulk, and then so we'll move then. So most of the talk then is of single cell sequencing of single embryos and what we can see in single embryos at the early stages. And so what we did, so we sequenced those bulk embryos at all those stages, and what one can see is that there is lots of genes that get upregulated around after gastrulation, but interestingly, so there are quite a few genes, so around a couple hundred, that start to be upregulated at very early stages, so from 16 cell stage onwards, so zygotic activation of the embryonic genome occurs at 8 and mostly at 16 cell stage. And so that's what you see here, that here all those genes start to come up 8 and then 16. And so there is quite a lot of action, in fact, before gastrulation that involves all these genes. And so here that's more to see, to for you to get an idea. So at 4 cell stage, the zygotic genome still completely silent, and so at 8 cell stage you start to have zygotic genome expression, and there you see you have a handful of genes that get upregulated. Very few genes get downregulated. One of the exceptions is cyclin B3, which is exactly that dot here, and that will lead to activation of the zygotic genome. And then you see that even as development progresses, you have more and more genes that get upregulated. And you see when you plot expression profile, temporal expression profile of individual genes, so it's kind of famous genes, so cordin important for gastrulation, Nopkin also is a famous gene in gastrulation, some growth factors, FGF, and some transcription factors, you see that there are extremely sharp upregulation of those genes at very specific stages, and especially quite early on. But obviously, there we mix the entire embryo. We have also different embryos. Yes?
Yeah. Can you also identify sort of the maternal transcripts that are degrading when looking south of the diagonal? Can you sort of make sense of those?
Yes. So actually, very few transcripts get degraded. And so
maternal?
Sorry?
Maternal transcripts?
Yes.
Oh.
And so some will appear to be degraded, but I think it's mostly by dilution, because when you start to activate the zygotic genome, then you can start to build up again all your housekeeping genes. So, and here I think that there is not so much degradation because development is so fast. So if you do a cell cycle in 20 minutes, you have to pattern as well. You have to change and then start to express new genes that you don't want to spend time to make one mRNA, make the protein, and then degrade it. And so in the data, so it will be very clear from single cell data that you just layer stuff on top of each other. And obviously, so in a In mammalian development, you have much more time, and so you could degrade the mRNAs. And so here, so I will show you quite a few embryos later, so it's to get its schemes of the early embryonic development, so two-cell embryos, four-cell embryos, eight-cell embryos, and so this at 16-cell stage embryo, so you start to have two different poles, so the animal pole that will form the future ectoderm, the vegetal pole that will form mesoderm and endoderm. And you have, and the embryos are oriented anterior and to the left and posterior to the right when you look at them on the side view. And so the important cells in those embryos, so you'll have, so some cells inherit maternal factors, and so they are depicted in blue. That's the germ cell lineage, and they are kept transcriptionally silent by the mRNAs they inherit from the mother. And so also important in green, so it's all the endoderm cells where invagination will initiate at gastrulation. And so gastrulation will initiate by constricting the apical surface of that those cells, and you'll have invagination then. But so mainly we are interested still at 16-cell stage embryo, where just at the onset of gastrulation. And so our strategy is to sequence to see the diversity of cells in that very simple system and see how much can we get from single-cell RNA-seq. And the idea is to dissociate individual embryos, pick all the cells or as many cells as possible of an embryo, and then sequence them individually by keeping track of which embryo they came from. And we do very high-depth single-cell RNA-seq, typically 100 to 1,000 times deeper than current studies, than most studies. And so basically it was a very expensive bet, but it kind of worked. And so
you lost the spatial information though?
Yeah, so here we lose the spatial information. And so I'll show you that surprisingly you can get the spatial information back from the data. And so that's the surprising thing about that.
And why did you decide a priori to do orders of magnitude more depth than other studies?
Because so there, most of the studies are so shallow, you see basically 1,000 genes, maybe. And so when you look back, if you take your bulk transcriptome, you see basically that tail. And so a lot of genes, so you don't see, so you see gene expression kind of in a binary mode, either I have my gene or not. So one is not very quantitative, and there is so much noise from that you sample so few transcripts at a time that is pretty much impossible then to be quantitative. And we thought the embryo is reproducible after all. PCR, if there is no strong bias in PCR in amplification, maybe if we go deeper, maybe we can see all those transcripts and then start to see fine changes in gene expression, for example, 20%, 30%. So that was the rationale, that if there is anything to see, that we should sequence deep enough not to have sampling issues of the mRNAs.
So Pierre, how did you actually quantitatively make that estimate? So if you look at the bulk, how do I actually get an estimate for what X I should have? How do you really make that, other than just go 1,000 times more or something? I mean, how do you really...
So you see there at the bottom that it widens.
Yeah.
So your sampling noise is the square root of n.
Good.
Mm-hmm. And so you have, obviously, if n is small, you have very large sampling noise.
Okay.
And so you want to be, you want to be high. You want to have many reads per transcript. And basically... And so, at the bottom line, so we want, though, that the single-cell sequencing should be kind of same depth as what usually one does for bulk sequencing. And so that's the bottom line. But people usually don't do that because they want to do many cells. And also, it's tedious to do single cells. So here we use SmartSeq2. It's very tedious to prepare the libraries. But basically, yeah, we do same depth of sequencing for one cell compared to one sample, one bulk sample. Yeah, that's the bottom line. Yes, Boris.
You don't worry about the PCR bias because you're going to look at things with function time, or
so
you really don't have to worry about it?
Well, I'll show you from the data, it seems there is absolutely no PCR bias between cells, but also if you are just interested in how a gene, a specific gene, is differentially regulated, then you can say that gene has a specific PCR bias, and then so then it does not matter for the comparison between genes. And so typically, so we map millions of reads per cell, and we can measure 8,000 genes that have expression of more than 4 reads per million mapped reads. And so to tell you, so 8,000 genes per cell, that's exactly the same number of genes we measure in bulk sequencing. And so you see we have pretty much no missing values because we can measure there, we sorted the genes according to their expression levels, and you can see that we detect robustly all the genes in all the cells. But here, that's the key, yeah, so you do, yeah, the depth is the same as bulk sequencing. Yes.
And what's your view on this recent paper about the biases, the stress responses elicited by the dissociation of cells prior to, you know, there was this paper in Nature Methods.
There we don't see anything, so we dissociate gently and then the embryos go on ice, so the cells go on ice, the collection is done on ice, so we don't see that. And so what happens very early on, so here we have single cells from two cell embryos, and you see, and we cluster the expression profiles, and you see that the embryos cluster by the cells of one embryo cluster together, and it's because each embryo has a slightly different maternal load of mRNAs. But at 4-cell stage embryos, it starts to be interesting. And so here, so you have profiles of individual cells of a single 4-cell embryo. And there, so you have two cells that look alike. So you see that there is pretty much no gene with more than twofold variation between the genes. It's extremely well correlated. It looks basically like the bulk sequencing. And so that's one cell pair, another cell pair. And when you take one cell from this pair and one cell from this pair, you see that some genes here in peak that are differentially regulated, and in fact they are differentially inherited from the mother.
So I have a question. Do you dissociate the cells and then you prepare libraries from individual cells by pipetting in individual wells?
Yes, exactly.
And are they barcoded?
Yes, and then it gets barcoded, yes.
And they're all loaded on the same sequencing reaction?
No. So there we have maybe 13 or 14 different runs.
But the point is that there are enormous biases from one sequencing reaction to the other, so it's very hard to compare.
Well, there is different sequencing reactions. So I would show you from the data, we don't see any bias like that. So all the libraries were prepared with the same batch of reagents. So there, yeah, so we coordinated with the sequencing facility to make sure that everything is processed at once. And then when you have the library, then it runs on the machine, and I guess it does not care. But yeah, we don't have batch effects because we use the same batch, basically. But we don't see, yeah, if you take, so we have embryos, so for example, one 16 cell stage embryo sequence in that library and another one in another library, you cannot make the difference. So if there are differences, it will be more embryo specific. And because of timing, and I will get to that towards the end of the talk.
Yeah, are you getting these from one mother or something as well?
So it depends. It depends how much you can collect at once, yeah. Because also it develops quite fast. And so typically, there will be batches, maybe 8 embryos from one individual. So the individuals they come from, it's not the only thing that matters is that as Fallusia is so polymorphic, that some individuals have specific alleles of some genes. And then it can get quite hard to basically to reconcile. So if you have never seen that allele before and it's not in our transcriptome assembly, basically you miss it. So we try to sum all the alleles of a specific gene together, but sometimes we miss some. And so here, actually, so there you see those, they don't have that gene. In fact, they don't have that allele because those embryos are from the same individual. And there, so you see some of those things, but usually it's not very important genes. At least developmentally important. And so there are a set of 27 mRNAs that are differentially segregated at the four cell stage embryos. And it's an interesting set because there are some signaling molecules like Wnt, and there are also transcription factors, RNA helicases, and things like that. So if we go then further in development in eight cell stage embryos, so we find two cells, so those blue cells I showed you on the skins will still inherit those maternal factors, so you see them here. So two cells per embryo, so here that embryo has only seven cells that pass quality control. And you start to have upregulation of some genes, so FKH is a forkhead transcription factor that gets upregulated in four cells of the embryo. But so that's very onset of gene expression. And then what happens if we go to 64 cell stage embryo? So what is the diversity of cells? And so now, Fallusia is a bilaterian, so we expect to have two copies of each cell and then maybe many different cell types. And so here we have an embryo that is more than 90% complete, so 58 cells of that embryo, and you see groups of two cells, so here, 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 and there, here, here, so groups of more cells, four cells, and more cells. And so there is quite some diversity in that embryo already, and here I can plot you the same type of plots as there were for the four-cell embryo, so you can find pair of cells with extremely well-correlated gene expression profiles. And so because you have one cell from the left side of the embryo and one cell from the right side of the embryo, and that already shows you that there is very little stochasticity in gene expression because the two sides, those two cell pairs that have not talked to each other basically since the zygote, express the same genes at the same level. And so actually that's remarkable that we see the bilateral symmetry of the embryo in the data. And so here, and to give you an idea of the differences between different cell types, so here we have two cells of two different cell types, and you see that there are quite a few changes in expression of typically a few dozens to a hundred genes, some genes upregulated in that cell type, so B7-8, so it will be future muscle cells, and some genes that are upregulated in B7-3, so future mesenchyme of the embryo. And so now, so we have that plot, but so what we would like to do is first, can we identify cell types in an unbiased manner, and then can we reconstruct the embryo from that data? And so first, we'll start with 16 cell stage embryo, so I told you it's the onset of zygotic gene expression, and we use non-negative matrix factorization to see if we can cluster the different cells in the embryo. So here you have 16 cells coming from the same embryo, and if we use, and so we use two metaprofiles, we split the embryo into two different parts, each with eight cells, and in fact it corresponds to the two poles of the embryo. If we use three metaprofiles, we split the embryo in five cell types. Two with four cells, in fact splitting this quadrant in two or four cells, and one with two and four and two. And if we use more profiles, basically it does not cluster as well. But in fact, the bottom line is that there are five cell types in 16 cell stage embryos, And we have quite a few embryos. So we have 11 embryos, and they can all, we can all attribute the exact same 5 cell types in these embryos. And so here, so there we have the maternal factors that get inherited in the future germ cells. They are transcriptionally silent. That's why, for example, in that embryo, you don't see any expression of any of the other genes. And so then you can see, yeah, there are those cell types, for example. And there, so you see that those embryos express more highly all those genes compared to these. And I'll get back to that towards the end. But so here it's kind of done ad hoc classification. Can we do that in a more systematic way that will be also applicable to different stages of embryo? So we devise something called section, which is basically we classify iteratively the cells by just cutting in half the embryo. And we do that, so we cut in half and then we take each part, cut again and cut again, till there is no more variation between the different cells that are left in the different different clusters we get.
And for this analysis, you don't care what genes are, right? You don't care
yes.
about their annotation.
Yes, it's completely blind to that. The only thing we care about is that there is variation between cells in the batch of starting cells we want to cluster. That's the only thing we care about.
And you cut them on along symmetry axes, along dorsal ventral plane?
No, no, that is cut.
Random cuts?
Or? No. It's cut by non-negative matrix factorizations.
Yes.
Sorry. No, it's cut that way.
Thank you.
And so that is done for individual embryos. And then obviously, so you have different classes for different embryos. Some embryos might be missing classes. And then we merge classes between embryos. So cell types that have similar profiles in different embryos are attributed the exact same profile. So I'll show you how that works. So in 16 cell stage embryo, so here it's exactly what I showed you before. So you first split in two exact halves. And so you can split that half again once more, and that can be split once and then another. And so that one cannot be split further, and that one can be split into two. We do that for another embryo, and it splits the same way. And we do that for the 11 embryos we had. Yes?
Yeah, just explain that third picture there, that top left block that you said does not split.
Yes.
What does that? What do you mean by that? If I split it, I somehow generate more?
No, so there you can look at the residual variation.
Yes.
So typically, let's say if I have those two cells in a cluster, in the cluster I got from splitting, there is pretty much no variation in gene expression between those two cells. So of course you can put a threshold on that. And there, but I would judge there is no variation remaining.
Meaning it's Poissonian or something?
Yes. And then so you cannot split.
So you stop when it's Poissonian?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. But if you have two cells that look like that, so of course then you can split those two cells. That's how we do. And then of course there is some noise, and so you can oversplit. But then when you merge the classes, so then they disappear naturally. And so here, so we find 5 classes in all the 11 embryos, and you can appreciate that the classes, then they have been colored, of course, by classes and given their actual Ascidian names. And so you can see that they all, from all one class cluster together, all one class cluster together. And that's how then we define the cell types of the embryos. So that's at 16 cell stage. Then we can go 32 cell stage when the embryo gets more complicated. And obviously we can split in way more cell types. So here we have 29 cells from a 32 cell embryo. And then at 64 cell stage, so that was the exact same embryo I showed you before. That's how one can split it. That specific embryo, we recover 17 different cell types. And in fact, so there are 18 different cell types in 64 cell-stage embryos, but that's at the end how the data looks like. So we have 5 cell types in 60-cell-stage embryos. The germ cells are here, so no expression of no zygotic expression. But so you see that there are quite some genes. So for example, those cells are called B5-1, so they express exclusively these genes, and you don't find them in any other cells. And so at 32 cell stage, so we have 8 cell types, and at 64 cell stage, we have 18 cell types out of 32 possible for a bilaterally symmetric embryo. So now the question, now we have the cell types from individual embryos for each stage of development. We know that gene expression is informed both by the history of the cells and also by the spatial position of the cells because they receive signals from their neighbors. And our question was, can we infer from gene expression both the history and the spatial position of the cells? So you can kind of think it of as an inverse problem. And first, the easy part, the history. So we can take the cell types and then looking from 2 subsequent stages where there is only 1 cell division between them, and we can then cluster the cell types using only the, so you have the mother cell types, the daughter cell types, you take only the gene expression from the mother cell types because you don't care. So the daughter should inherit the gene expression from the mother and then put on top some daughter-specific gene expression. And so if we do it that way, so we can cluster the cell types by conserving also the total cell number. We find that the cell types of, if you sum up all the cells of the daughters, you get exactly the number of cells of the mothers times 2. And so from 16 to 32, and also 32 from 64. That works quite well. And then with that, we can reconstruct the lineage tree of the cell types in the embryo, starting from 2 cell stage. So in ascidians, they have what's called the B lineage. So the animal pole is made of the small A lineage, the small B lineage, vegetal pole, capital A lineage, capital B lineage. And you see, so there are way more cell types in the vegetal pole that is both endoderm and mesoderm, and there are fewer cell types in the animal pole that is ectoderm. So those cells are future neurons, future brain, future neurons here. Most of that is epidermis. And so yes.
Sorry, I was going to ask, how do you assign the specific cell identities according to the nomenclature? Are the numbers of cells and their lineage relationships in the different, like from the 2-cell stage on, are different enough for, let's say, the 4 quadrants that you can do this unambiguously?
Yes, so there we, so I guess there are 2 elements from the question. So of course there is quite lots of things known about Siona. So we can identify the cells from their Siona gene expression profiles.
Okay, so now you do care about the genes.
Yeah, now we do care about the genes.
Okay.
But I will show you that as we can reconstruct the spatial organization from the gene expression, and if we have the history from the imaging, we could attribute the cell types without the information from Siona as well.
That's yeah. How is that? But you need to know the names in the image.
Yeah. No.
So you're still using genes to give names to cells in the image, and then looking them up, the names and gene expression.
Yes. Yeah. But here, I guess what I was trying to tell Cassandra. So there at the 64 cell stage embryo, it's established, you know, which cell expresses which marker. So for example, MyOD is in the future muscles, and then if you see MyOD expression, you know it's a future muscle cell, and then you can give its name. And you don't care about all the other genes. But the bottom line is that there might be better markers than those, but also that we can attribute them. So from the tree, we know where the germ cells are, though, so we can attribute basically one quarter of the embryo by knowing. So we know they are germ cells. Actually, that's the next stage. So from imaging, there is asymmetric partitioning of volume in the germ cell lineage. So the germ cells here that are in blue, so B5-2, are much smaller than their siblings, so B5-1, from the 16-cell stage onwards, right? The 16-cell stage, 32-cell stage, and 64-cell stage. And so you have reduction in volume, and so you inherit pretty much all the maternally inherited transcripts in that single cell. And so there is, though, a relative increase in the RNA concentration of those genes that we see exactly that. And so we can, from that data, we can compute, we can infer that there is a reduction in volume, and actually if we plug in the volume we measure from the light sheet data, we find that, in fact, the RNA, the total RNA amount is constant in that germ cell lineage.
So how, let's say that you had no gene identity data. Yeah. How far do you think you would be able to get in the reconstruction?
So that's what I will show you with the next slide, is that we can, and I guess I can draw, I will draw embryos, how then one can interpret them from the data and without the identity. And so we know the classes, and so now we try to infer spatial organization from the data, and we start at the 16-cell stage where there is zygotic gene expression, and typically where potentially you can have morphogenesis, but there might be a morphogenetic field happening at that stage. So if we do principal component analysis, and then we can align the axis with the cell types we obtained from before, from the poles. So you see that we separate cells along two axes. So you have a group of 8 cells here. You have a group of 8 cells there. And so those are aligned and those are aligned. And so, in fact, it corresponds to the animal pole there, the vegetal pole there. And there you have anterior, posterior. And I guess to go back to Cassandra's question, and so the way then I would draw the embryo, so there, so you have 2 sets of cells, and so those set of cells, so typically, so if we say, so anterior that way, so that set of cells, so we have 4 and 4 cells, so you could say the embryo looks like that. So that would be the animal pole. And the vegetal pole, so you have 4 cells, 2 cells, 2 cells. So I would draw, basically you would have an embryo that looks like that. So 2 pancakes, 1, so 2 rows of cells, and then on the other side it looks like that. That's how I would infer. And then so you can try, and then you can try to fit that on the embryo itself. But schematic wise, yeah, I would do that. And it's not so far from how the actual embryo then might look like. So that's at 16-cell stage. So now what happens if we go to 32-cell stage using the exact same map as what was computed for 16-cell stage? And you see that it works pretty well. So you have there in the same color, so we have the exact same, the spatial position of the cells is recapitulated in that map. And notably, so here, so this cell, so B5-1, will divide and give rise to 2 daughters, so B5, B6-1 and B6-2. And so they are separated that way, the same way they are separated in the embryo. And same here. So those cells will give rise to different cell types, 6-1 and 6-3 and 6-2 and 6-4, and they're also separated that way. And because those cells have cell divisions that are oriented from vegetal to animal pole. And basically, so you have all the daughters that touch the animal pole then become something else. And well, of course, do not get animal pole identity, but they see morphogens that are more, that are closer to what the animal pole cells do. So how does it work? So there we have two axes, so animal pole, vegetal pole, and we also have anterior-posterior. And so how does the anterior-posterior axis might be established? And so we think, so the future germ cells, so here at the bottom, there and there, they express high expression of WNT5 that they inherit asymmetrically from the zygote. And so you have graded expression of WNT5 in an anteroposterior way. And interestingly, so you have the opposite gradient of a metalloprotease called TK1 that will degrade WNT. And so you have, and that way then you can set up a gradient along the anteroposterior axis. And that is doable because you have inherited basically in the pole, in one of the poles, something, a morphogen. Yes.
Can I repeat Cassandra's question? Did you pick WNT5 and TK1 because you knew those were the right things to do?
No. So here, so we have, so to set up the axis, so it's natural to think at the 16-cell stage, all the cells are equivalent, except for the future germ cells, because they have those 27 different mRNAs that the other cells don't have. And then if you look at the list of those mRNAs, so there is only one signaling molecule, that is WNT5. So yeah, the fact that we have basically then all the genes, so if we can look at the gene names, then if you want to try to find the what might be the important genes, then it's a very restricted list of genes. And so graded genes along the anterior-posterior axis the other way, there is that forkhead, FKH, that I mentioned before, but there are very few. There are very few others. Yes.
My question is probably redundant with the one you just got. So how much do the principal components change between stages, like when you move from 16 cells to 32 cells? Are they exactly the same principal components, or the entire transcriptome is changing but still somehow is keeping its relative proportions? And the second question is, how many genes are important for each principal component? So is it that one principal component is actually WNT5, or is it a linear combination of a lot of genes?
Yeah, so the first question, so for the principal components, so when you go later in development, so what stays strong is the animal pole, vegetal pole difference. Then you cannot make much sense of the rest, because then you start to have too many cell types. Okay?
But like when you move between 16 and 32, yeah, things are not too scrambled, right?
Yeah, but at 32, I've used the same components as at 16.
Yes.
Yeah, they're exactly the same. Yeah. And because if you do the same analysis on the 32 cell stage embryo, basically it looks different, because then you start to attribute changes you start to attribute importance to genes that get upregulated at 32-cell stage. But here, what it means, though, is that the 32-cell stage embryo still reads the same morphogenetic field as the 16-cell stage embryo. So as a comparison to Siona, because Fallusia and Siona are still maybe 100 million years divergent. even though they look the same. So we can see, we can compare the different cell types. And so here, so we have our data in Fallusia, and so data in Siona from Mike Levin's lab. And so you can see here some maternal factors with some famous names. So VASA is a famous germ cell determinant. And so you can see that, yeah, we inherit those maternal genes specifically. And so you can appreciate, so in Mike Levin's paper, they did not do sequencing as deep as us. And so you can see that their data is much more noisy. Actually, all those genes are identified in Siona to be differentially inherited. And in fact, so their data should look like ours, if it was noisy, basically. So at 8-cell stage, it's completely established that all those genes, except for VASA, are strongly asymmetrically apportioned, and there you can barely see it from the data. But it does not mean it's not true, because it's true in, yeah, it's true from in situs, and it's also true if you do the RNA-seq deep enough. And then if we go at 16-cell stage, so we have some example of genes that classify the different cells, and there you have, again, because the data is noisy, you cannot do the classification as well. They knew from their picking which cell was which, and so we use their labels, but you see, for example, TBX6B, they don't detect at all, although they detect both by in situ and qPCR, and we have 100%, we have extremely good detection. And something that I mentioned, so you have graded expression, for example, of TK1, but also that forkhead transcription factor, FKH, also called FOXA, that from anterior to posterior, and it's the same in Siona. And then what happens at the 64 cell stage? So here we have projected on the same axis everything, and you see that one cannot. So the 64 cell stage cell types are seven in the name, so A7 or B7, and so you see that one cannot really distinguish cell types. So for example, those and those guys, and so it meaning that the morphogenetic field at 16 cell stage does not work anymore. And so the idea now, so obviously 64 cell stage was two cell divisions after 32, and quite a few genes have changed since then. And so we thought maybe then what gets expressed at 32 cell stage gets important, and then you have to recompute the morphogenetic field at each stage. So if you know the models, you can compute the morphogenetic field they would produce, and then see how can you separate the daughters. And so as an idea, so we had anteroposterior axis be specified at 16 cell stage, but then maybe at 32 cell stage you have a second axis in the vegetal pole. And indeed, that's what happens. So if we can classify, as use as second axis, the classifier of B6-1 and B6-2, and now so you see that we can map the spatial organization of the genes, of the cells, very well. So B7-6 are the future germ cells, that's why they don't fit in the map, but we see if we go clockwise that we have B7-1-2, and then 7-3, 7-4, 7-8, and 7.5 are at the bottom, and so 7-7 is more inwards, and so that recapitulates very well. Yes?
What do you mean by classifier?
So now we look, what are the genes, you know, that separate those guys? Because so we had
first eigenvector.
Sorry?
And you picked the first eigenvector when you
came. Yes. And we can do the same. So we have the B cells and the A cells, and we can do then the same classifiers for the A cells. In fact, they are very similar to the between the two, but it works better if we do it than cell type specific. And here we do exactly the same, and so we find the same organization. So meaning, that cells do indeed respond to their local environment, and that really informs their gene expression. And if you have enough resolution, you can reconstruct that. And so at the end, so we can really attribute all the cell types in the embryo as what was defined by single-cell RNA-seq, and we have more cell types. So, for example, we split the endoderm in way more cell types than was previously appreciated. And so now we have complete history of gene expression and also the spatial expression, so we can have make for each gene basically how the gene expression profile changes over time. And you see, for example, here that FGF that gets upregulated in the vegetal pole, you see that there is a bit of a gradient. And so we can do that for all the genes basically. And so now a bit about how do cells will change their shape, and can we see, can we try to attribute that to the gene expression changes? And so between 8 and 16 cell stage embryos, so the animal cells will become flatter. So here, just plot the relative apical area to the total area of the cell. And that happens at a given contact, apical contact perimeter. So you have from kind of dome shape, you just flatten the cells. And so you see it. There are 8 cell stage, so the two poles are the same at 16 cell stage, so the animal pole is more flattened than the vegetal pole, and at 32 cell stage even further. And so can we find an explanation in our data, because now we know what are the differences in gene expression between animal and vegetal pole, and an obvious, so there are not so many changes in expression of so many genes. So there are many transcription factors, they are signaling molecules, but then if you look at more cell biology related molecules, there are very few of them, but there are many protocadherins though. And so you have a protocadherin that is expressed in the animal pole, you have many protocadherins that are expressed in the vegetal pole, and now if we compute the cation contact strength defined as we sum over all the apical contact of a given cell of the minimal of expression of that cation between the two neighboring cells and sum that over all the contacts, we find that there is a very nice anticorrelation with the apical area for a specific cation, for that protocation X-linked. And so those cells that have a larger relative apical area, in fact, is exactly that cell that has fewer neighbors that express the same cation. And so the correlation, anticorrelation is almost perfect at 16 cell stage when the flattening starts to happen, and is still present at the 32 cell stage. And one can ask then, yeah, is the flattening dependent then on cation? Because now we infer that the flattening is to the expression of cation, and if we put the embryos in calcium-free seawater, so we don't change the relative apical area of the vegetal pole cells, but we do, the animal pole cells cannot flatten anymore. And so we can do that for the 64 cell stage, so the vegetal pole did not change much till the 32 cell stage, but now there starts to be an expression, a wide variation in apical, relative apical area. And the vegetal pole expresses many cations in a very intricate pattern. And actually, we think that there is only one, at least that matters, or originally it's cation 7. And the other cations are probably important later for gastrulation, because actually here, so in the cells that are in red that express 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 different cations are the ones that will invaginate. But very likely those cations are not important at that 64 cell stage. And so obviously, so there is pattern expression of signaling ligands that enabled the diversification of cell types. And so as we have the history of gene expression, we have the history of gene expression in every cell, and we know what it was and what it's going to become. So we can look what would be the transcription factor cascades that happen in those cells. So here you have sorted on the animal. On the left side, the animal pole cells. On the right side, the vegetal pole cells, and development goes outward. And you can appreciate that the cells on either extremity express much way more transcription factors than they do originally. And actually what happens is that in each cell type you have a layered, you have a cascade of expression of transcription factors, so typically expressing one or two only transcription factors. So first at 16 cell stage, and then you start to upregulate at 32 cell stage another layer of transcription factors, keeping the first layer on. And then at 64 cell stage, you express cell type specific transcription factors, and usually just one. And so for example here, you have two sister cells, so one that will become muscle, so expressing MyOD, and one becoming mesenchyme, expressing MNX, another transcription factor. And so, to finish, so people talk a lot about noise during development, and so far we have seen very little noise in our data. So where does the noise come from, apart from technical reasons? And so here, so I project again on my map all my 16 cell stage embryos, forgetting where the embryos came from. And now you see that we cannot really identify. So in those two clusters, the cells have been colored accordingly to their cell types. But obviously, if I would not know which cell types they belong to, I could not distinguish them. And same at the bottom. And so where does variability, but now if I color again where they are, which embryos they belong to, so you see, so in a graded way, you see that, in fact, the top cells there belong to the same embryo, the bottom cells belong to the same embryo, and same at the bottom. And so we have slight differences in progression, in embryonic progression, because the cells have been collected maybe a few minutes apart. If the embryos were not staged, you know, to the second, and that makes a big difference. And actually, if I, for example, take a specific gene, so you can see here individual embryos and the cells from that specific embryo at 16 cell stage and at 32 cell stage, the transcription factor that is specifically expressed in the animal pole cells, and you see the upregulation of that transcription factor in the different embryos. But you see that within an embryo, there is not much variability. But you see here at 32 cell stage embryos that you have a ramping up of the transcription factor over time. And at 16 cell stage, the data looks more noisy because you ramp up very fast. And then so you will sample. Then the noise then comes naturally because you sample something that ramps up super fast. And you see, in fact, that those embryos, kind of late 16 cell stage embryos that start to look a lot like early 32 cell stage embryos, do not have that noise anymore. And I guess. And so we, Jean-Karim Richer, has made a website where one can browse that data. So digitalembryo.org, you can look up your favorite gene and see where it's expressed and in which cell type it's expressed. And with that, I will conclude that despite, so very few people say that, but single-cell RNA-seq, in fact, is not so noisy. And so you can determine both cell types in an unbiased manner. And you also, more interestingly, so you can infer the spatial position of the cells and their history. So history people have been doing, but that you can infer the spatial position of the cells is interesting. And that, and there is a very high reproducibility within embryos. And in fact, yeah, we see the bilateral symmetry of the embryos, meaning that in fact stochasticity in gene expression does not happen that much, at least during development. And I guess that's why also, development is reproducible.
So,
yes.
I wonder, could you go back? So your third statement there, the termination of other daughter relationships.
Yes.
So am I right in understanding your latest stage in this study was the 112 cell stage?
The 64 cell stage.
64 cell stage.
Yes.
And then from 2 to 64 cells, in every case, for every cleavage, the transcriptional profiles always matched what you would expect from other daughter relationships?
Yes.
Up to this point?
Okay. Yes.
I just wanted to understand
yes.
that.
Yes. And I guess, yeah, your question reminds me of the point I wanted to make. So traditionally, ascidians are the posterior children of mosaic development. Here, the only asymmetric mRNA inheritance we see are in the germ cells. Because obviously, so their mother-daughter relationships work so well because the daughters have the gene expression of their mothers. Yeah. If it would be that one daughter inherits, you know, like those 100 mRNAs yeah. from those 100 genes, and the other daughters inherit something different, yeah. you know, there that will break up.
Yeah. No, yes. It's an interesting point, and I just think it highlights how important it is to have the context for these scRNA-seq. So often people are doing our single-cell RNA-seq on very mature, complex
yes.
organs
yes.
and using similar expression patterns to infer mother-daughter relationships,
yes.
which is inappropriate.
Yes.
Because we know that at late stages in different conditions, cells can converge on the same gene expression profiles without lineage. But in your case, you have a very specific context where we don't see that happening.
Yes. Yeah. Well, and also because, yeah, we would match, so that we match cell types with the immediate cell division before.
Yes, and you actually have a lineage, which is
yes.
not the case for most
yes,
things.
Yes, exactly. And that if we, and also that we have so many genes also help us. Because, for example, there are two muscle cells. Well, at least, well, four muscle cells, in fact, but if you would say I clump together all the MyOD expressing cells, like what TSNE would do,
right.
you know, there it would break
yeah.
as well, exactly as what you mentioned, that there might be two ways, that might be two ways to make the exact same cell type. Yeah. Yes.
So these are cleavage divisions. So as the cells get to half the volume each time.
Yes.
How far could you push this before the reproducibility from the same cell, as it gets smaller and smaller, there's less RNA.
Yes.
And so you're getting a lower percentage of all the, or you're getting fewer transcripts. So if you went much beyond 64 cells, do you think any of this would still work?
Yes, I would.
Would it work in a small cell? These are big cells, right?
They are not. They start to be of the order of magnitude of a HeLa cell at the end, or at 64 cell stage.
Same size as my whole shoot apical meristem.
Yes.
Okay. That's why I'm asking.
But I think I would say, so at 64, there is a bit more noise, but not that much more.
Uh-huh.
And especially, so in the genes, then that matter. So, for example, the cell type-specific transcription factors, usually they are upregulated at quite high levels.
Mm-hmm.
So you might,
okay.
yeah. So you might not see a gradient as well, but you will, for sure, see the different cell types.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say that there will be enough RNA. There should be enough RNA, even if the cells would be 10 times smaller. I don't see. So I think that should still work, given
smaller in volume, so
yes.
two times smaller in diameter.
Yes, yeah. Yeah,
okay. So
yeah 100 times smaller, I don't know, but.
But you saw the variability increasing.
Yeah, yes, so the variability increases,
yeah.
yes, yeah. Yes, certainly.
Yes. Yeah. So this inference, of course, is really pretty amazing. But how about just fluorescent in situ hybridization? So now that you know what cell expresses
yes.
What RNA, can you come back and you know with fish and just see that you assigned them correctly?
Yes. Yeah, well, there, so we also know it's the correct position because in Siona, people have hybridized all the transcription factors, so that's 500 genes. So you can just look up which transcription factor is expressed in which cell, and then it matches exactly what we have.
you mentioned the FGF gradient in, I think, on the animal side?
Yeah, there is a bit of an FGF gradient on the vegetal side, yeah.
So how far can you push this sort of inference? So there's a bit of a gradient, so is this a real bit?
Well, there, yeah, I believe, well, the gradient is real. Whether it's functional, I don't know. But the gradient, anyway, might reflect. So there is graded expression of some transcription factors. And if, and very likely, you know, genes that are downstream of that transcription factor might be expressed in a graded manner. So the gradients we see, I totally believe, because if you look within one cell type, so the variability is smaller than, you know, in the next cell type that expresses less. So on average, we have, yeah, 15% variance in technical noise, 10 to 15% variance. So we, you know, measuring 50%, then it's piece of cake. Then. Yes.
Because this thing is transparent, presumably you've got immunohistochemistry in the system. You could actually light up things like phospho-SMAD. You could probe the protein pools that you know are responsible for signaling and match them to the transcriptome, right? In space, because you could just take can you get a PSMAD nuclear localization? Can you get those kind of images? That would be, because then you can really get to how do these gradients get, these transcriptal gradients get formed? They get formed by protein dynamics and signaling systems, right?
Yes.
So if you could image that would be.
Well, there, so the wind, so I would say probably the wind gradient is the most important one.
But that was still a transcriptional gradient. I'm saying.
No. It's an RNA. Well, so the thing.
It was RNA-seq.
Sorry?
It's a transcriptional gradient.
Yeah, yes, it's a transcriptional gradient, yes.
You're not looking at the signaling pool that's protein.
Yeah. Well, there, yeah, I guess, yeah, it's. Make a good point. So there we assume that you make the same, the number of proteins will scale with the RNAs. But I would say, I guess it's safe to say, even though we have a transcriptional gradient, that there has to be a protein gradient. Yeah, but one could look at that. Yeah, I would like to thank the people. So yeah, Hannah did all the analysis. So Ulla and Lars contributed all the imaging, and we got very nice support from the genomics core facility to make sure we had a nice working protocol before we started. Thank you.